Well, hello out there in the land of sea. I'm Trish England, and welcome to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wollin and the Racing History Project. Can you believe this? All of our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, also on the Internet Archive, archive.org. We hope you were in tune for last month's blockbuster show with David Hobbs, Derek Bell, and John Fitzpatrick. But if you missed it, you can find it on our website, www.racinghistoryproject.com. So far, I've just been told, there have been 10,000 downloads of that show. Ta-da! We've got a really special event tonight, a roundtable discussion with some of the heroes of the showroom stock endurance racing battle of the old days, IMSA's Flower Hawk series, and the SCCA's Playboy and Escort series. Here's where fans could watch actual streetcars jiving on some of the best endurance tracks in the North America. Laguna Seca, Road Atlanta, even lonely Nelson Ledges, and Mossport, alive and screaming for 6, 12, or 24 hours. These two series fill the necessary niche in the racing and automotive industries that was fun, competitive, relatively inexpensive to run, and the cars were attainable to the average driver. Dave Wollin, who raced in both of these series and wrote the book on it called Showroom Stock, we'll lead this off, and then we'll be talking to Charlie Downs, Mitch Wright, Bobby Archer, Martin Mitchell, Randy Popes, and Rick Titus, all winners in these series. Panel people, please, if you don't mind, announce yourself before you speak by name so we'll know your voices. I can't tell. Sorry, I've got hay fever. So, audience, please mute your phone. If you have a question, just send it via chat, and our producer will pass it along. So, here's Dave.
Well, thanks, Trish. And by the way, I see John Torek just signed in. We'll plug him into the discussion. He was active in all these series also, won quite a bit. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you, David?
And for the benefit of our audience, many of whom weren't around back in the day, let me briefly tell you about the history of showroom stock racing. If you haven't bought my book, Showroom Stock, there's still some available on the Racing History Project website, on Amazon, at Audible in Burbank, and it'll tell you all about it. But in the beginning, of course, everything was showroom stock. You went to the racetrack with your MG, folded down the windshield, raced, taped up the headlights, and then drove it home. And then people started to modify it, and they became different classes, and they were stock and modified. And then in the 1970s, SCCA started a class for showroom stock cars. They have delivered no modifications, etc. It became a very popular category. No exhaust noise, that's a lot of tires for you. Well, in 1980, Northeast Ohio region SCCA, at an obscure racetrack called Nelson Ledges, decided to put on a 24-hour race. The race attendants basically guys from Detroit, all the journalists thought it was a good thing to do. First race was won by a Saab, sponsored by Road and Track magazine. The next year won by a Pinto, sponsored by Car and Driver. And it took off from there. So when Mitsubishi asked me about the next best place for racing, something that wouldn't cost very much, I said, let's go to Nelson Ledges. So I lied, of course. I said, of course, we can win, and it'll be good exposure. And at the end of the Nelson Ledges race in 1984, I don't know if any of you guys were there, you might have been. We were a bunch of us standing around talking, and a guy by the name of Ken Patient, who was a showroom stock racer from New England, said, you know, we got a six-hour endurance race at Lime Rock, why don't you come to it? And Dick Grosbrand, who was running the Carrera team, said, boy, if we could have a series, I'll put on a race with Willis Springs. Jim Truman, who owned the Red Roof Inns hotel chain along the Mid-Ohio Raceway, said, I'll put on a race at Mid-Ohio, maybe another 24 hours. And Bill King, the marketing director from SCCA at the time, who happened to be there racing also, said, hey, maybe we got a series. I'll go back to Denver and see what I can do. And a couple of days later, we put it together. We called it the U.S. Endurance Championship. There was no prize money except an individual racetrack. We put a trophy at the end of the season. And incidentally, at the Mid-Ohio 24-hour race in 1984, the IMSA PR guy, Lee Gardner, came around asking people if we'd all learn in an intro service that series. And of course, we all said yes. And then he found that the tire companies were pretty much committed to SCCA and liked the competition. So Firehawk, who didn't want to compete, became the sponsor of the intro series. And the first Firehawk race at Sebring in 1985, many of you guys I know were there, it was a great event. It was phenomenal. 100 cars. I don't remember who won. I didn't. We had two Mirages down there around the middle of the field. But we had a great time, and it took off from there. SCCA, again, coming back to our SCCA discussion, their first race in 1985, part of the Playboy Endurance Series. They had found some sponsorship in Playboy Magazine. And the first race ran at Riverside, where due to a variety of screw-ups, there were no race results for a week. But it went on from there. There were 8 races, a couple 24-hour races, and so on. The following year became the Escort Radar Detective Series in 1986. Same thing in 87 and 88. At the end of 88, SCCA decided that 24-hour races, endurance races, were too much.
Some old race car driver.
One-hour races, which are still growing to some extent. The Insta Series continued right until the middle 90s.
Okay, fine. It's Victor Ventress.
One of you guys, I'm going to ask who
Hello.
Would be there. Who was that?
Hello.
Yeah, who's that?
I hear Dave.
Yeah.
Yep, and he's doing the show, so just sit back and relax.
Yeah.
Sit back and relax. Hell, I can't get any more relaxed. You know how many beers I've had? Hey.
Mute your phone if you're not talking to me. Who was at that first race in 1985?
Who was what?
Lance.
This is Rick.
Randy
I
was.
There.
Was.
What was the question?
Who was at the first race at Sebring in 1985?
I was, Dave.
Yeah, I think Randy was. Charlie, were you down there for that? I don't know.
Yes, sir.
And Lance, maybe Lance was. Anyway, it went on from there. So let's start off. Actually, Lance Stewart, are you there?
I'm here.
Tell us about your Escort and Firehawk experience, beginning to end.
Whoa.
In 5 minutes.
Well, I got lucky. I got lucky, and I got invited to the Honda Gong Show by Dix Erickson. And so I made it onto the team for the 1986 season. And so I raced with Honda in Firehawk and World or Escort for several years before I got the Mazda deal, and then again came back to it after, like in 1991, came back and did some more of it.
And Mark Mitchell, mm-hmm. you were around there in the beginning. When did you get started in Firehawk?
In Firehawk or Escort?
Oh, both.
Well, that same Gong Show, my good friend Lance got me in the following year on that Gong Show, and I kind of made it onto that Honda team, which at that point it was Dix and Charlie Kernet, and that was like the clandestine American Honda team before John got his effort going a couple years later. And first race I ever did was the 24-hour at Mid-Ohio. In 87, and we won, Lance and I and Mark Wolokichuk, and it was an amazing experience. I was hooked from that point on.
That's right. You were actually in the early days of Playboy. You got to drive the Toyota Thunderbird and had a little discussion there on Facebook today about that. Tell us about that Thunderbird. You and Andy Pilgrim, what a team.
That's correct. And actually, prior to that, I drove Pontiac Firebird and Firehawk on some West Coast races, and I want to say it was 86. Drove a Fiat Bertone with Kim Baker, and I believe Bobby and Tommy, were you in on that deal as well?
Not the Fiat.
fewer on that.
The 24
hours, not then, 20 more minutes.
yeah. Well, And then with Toyo Tire sponsorship with Andy and Jeff Beitzel built Thunderbird, which was actually an amazing car. I mean, it was amazingly quick. and then I got hooked up with, again, Kim Baker, well, with the Corvette, and with Tommy and Bobby Archer and Sean Hendricks and a few others, and then with the Archer brothers with some escort and world challenge stuff after that. So it was right place, right time, as I think a lot of the rest of the folks will say, you know, just it was luck, you know, just being there and had a lot of fun. Drove with Eddie Meekum as well, with his John Heinrichsy and Don Knowles and Leighton Reese and Mark Hutchins were our teammates on that program. So I was really fortunate to be in, you know, with some really good teammates and some really good cars.
Hey, Randy Post, you started out at Sebring. I know you went to Escort, Firehawk, and a bunch of other things besides. Tell us about it.
Well, I had a couple of firsts in showroom stock racing. For one, the very first Firehawk race at Sebring in 1985 is the very first race I ever ran. I had never run any race of any kind. And by doing SCCA schools and getting an SCCA provisional license, even though I never raced, I could turn that into an IMSA provisional license. And it was in the compact division race, which is a 1 hour before the quote-unquote big Firehawk race. And so that was the very first Firehawk race that ever happened, and it was the very first race I ever ran. And then I got in the Escort Series for the first time. I think it was later that year, Dave Wolin, wasn't it, when I drove, you let me drive your Mitsubishi Starion in the middle of the night at Mid-Ohio 24-hour because I was racing my VW Golf there in Volkswagen Cup. I did Volkswagen Cup and Firestone Firehawk compact division with the same car. And we'd have to switch the suspension and the stickers back and forth. And a bunch of other guys did that, like Paul and Carl Hacker, who were really super Volkswagen Cup racers. And then I did almost every Firestone Firehawk race ever, many of them with T.C. Klein Racing and Hondas. I think P.D. Cunningham might have coined the term PP cars. We were always in the touring class. Or the
that wasn't PD. It was a Grand Sports guy. I can't remember who it was off the top of my head, but he was the one that made a remark at a driver's meeting about the PP cars.
Oh, no kidding. And so one of they were great to drive, but what happened when you were in the touring class, and this is true of all racing when you have multiple classes, we always ended up having to deal the fastest drivers in touring class, as you guys all know, you were normally dealing with the worst drivers in the Grand Sports class. So you'd be in a 100-horsepower Honda, trying to race with a bad driver and a 250 or 300-horsepower, depending on how much it was worked on, Camaro or Firebird. It was an interesting game, and it was the key to winning, was being able to do that and not get crashed.
That's right. Charlie Downs, you were there in the beginning, too.
Yes. Originally, I started out in Renault Cup and actually came into Escort through Dave with the Mitsubishi team. It was the second multi-ethnic team that I'd raced with. Originally, the Renault Cup team was a really true multi-ethnic team, but came into with Mitsubishi at Nelson Ledges, then went on to getting into the Gong Show at Honda because of who brought me in? It was I can't think of his name right now, but ended up at Honda after Mitsubishi. And various teams, World Challenge with teams out of New York, Jamaican-run teams, AJ Ashley and a few others, and just went from there. Didn't compete in every race because it was just up to who would take a chance with me. So that was my introduction to the three series, Renault Cup, Escort, and Firestone.
Hey, Bobby Archer, you were kind of late coming to the Southern Stock business, but I know you were busy in IRS and such. What was your first experience there with Firehawk or Escort?
Well, it's like a collage that just all went from one play to another, but Tommy and I were driving Chevy Cavaliers in IMSA and struggling with that deal. And on a Tuesday night before the last race of 85, John Dinkle calls us up, and Tommy and I were both selling cars at that time, and he goes, would you be interested in running a Corvette in the Playboy series? And I go, well, I've never even sat in a Corvette before, but sure, why not? And I go, you know, when is it? He goes, this Friday. So this is Tuesday night. So as luck would happen, Tommy and I had a meeting with Herb Fischel Wednesday morning in Detroit. And we wouldn't be out of there till Thursday afternoon. So we went to Detroit, and, of course, you had to wear a suit if you went to meet Herb Fischel from Chevrolet. And the meeting went long, and we were going to go right from there to Mid-Ohio. So Tommy and I show up Thursday afternoon at Mid-Ohio to drive with Kim Baker and John Dinkle. So we show up in our three-piece suits, and made a big, you know, entrance. And lo and behold, you know, Kim put the car on the pole, and we won the race. Up until that time, all the Corvette teams were kind of running by the fuel gate. And that was one of our favorite tracks for us. And we ran the race flat out. In my recollection, we won by 10 laps or something, which worked out well, because I think there was a $50,000 bonus. So then after that, we still had a deal to run Cavaliers the next year, and Kim hired us. You know, Mitch was on the team, and we won the championship in 86. I think we ended up winning like 6 out of 8 races. And then we did it again in 87, won the championship again. And that led, in 88, we drove the Saline Mustangs at Mossport and won that 24-hour race. And then at that time, we were also running the trucks for Jeep, and we run the Corvettes in the Corvette Challenge Series. And in the fall of 88, we took first and second at Mid-Ohio in the Corvettes, first, second, and third at Mossport in the Mustangs, and we took first and second with the Jeeps. And at that point, Walter Voss from Jeep said, I don't want to share you with any other manufacturers. I'll pay you to stay home. I don't want you racing Fords or Chevrolets anymore. And Tommy and I said, this isn't going to work, because if you're kind of out of sight, you're out of mind.
Yep.
So fortunately for us, the Eagle Talon came around, and we put that deal together in like 13 days. And we won the Escort Endurance Championship with the Talon. In fact, the team, including Mitch, I think we won the championship like 5 years in a row. So, yeah. Escort Endurance was good to us. And along the way, I also ran a couple Firehawk races with Ray Corman in the BMW. We should have won 2 races, but Ray always wanted to pit first and took a couple wins away. I think I was driving with John Andretti. But I'm not a big fan of Firestone tires, so that was almost torture for me.
Well, you know,
so that's kind of it in a nutshell for Bobby Archer.
Yeah, at that first Sebring Firehawk race, I think everybody complained about the tires, Dave Rowland, by the way. And we all hated them and then discovered that, gee, everybody had the same issues. Even though the tires were terrible, all the other guys had terrible tires, too. And probably all the way through Firehawk, the cars went a lot faster if you put a different tire on them. But in the Firehawk series, they had to have Firestones. We had a win at Riverside in 85 in a Mirage Turbo, which, by the way, George Silverman said, don't ever bring this car back. And found the secret is running, I don't know, 40 pounds more air in the rear than in the front. And the heat cycle tires, and they work best on their third heat cycle. So I have a whole lot of tires burned in. Anyway, so much for Firestone. Rick Titus,
well,
spent a lot of time.
We were at Charlotte when the RS series went to Firestone. And going around, you know, the banking at Charlotte, I came in and said, these tires are crap. I went to Al Spiry and said, how good are these tires? You know, what's the temperature? He goes, well, they're good till about 200 degrees. And I go, mine was 285. Oh, well, they must be good for 285 then.
Yeah.
Not a fan of Al Spiry either.
In RS cars or anything, Charlotte was terrifying on skinny little tires.
Yeah.
Anyway, Rick Titus, you won the championship in 88, I think it was. And
87, yeah.
About your experience,
well, I was duped because my father won the Daytona 24-hour in 68 and 69 in the Trans Am group, first in a Mustang for Shelby and then a Firebird. And so as a teenager in high school, that just looked glamorous as hell to me. So I one evening made the mistake of saying to my father, boy, Dad, you must just love these 24-hour races. And he looked at me like I was a moron and said, no, they're bloody hard work. Well, they found out they are bloody hard work. Of course, I can't help but grin every time somebody uses the term showroom stock because every one of the pros on this panel didn't drive cars that were showroom stock. As you well put to me in 1988, you know, Rick, the problem with rules is it costs so damn much money to get around them. Those cars were well-developed, and those guys who actually bought cars off showrooms and came to race with us kind of got an ass-whooping because he got a lot of good shoes. I mean, he got Lance Stewart, and Lance knows how I feel about him. And I had the good fortune on Dave Wallen's team to be Lance's teammate at Sebring when they needed to wrap up the championship. I was on the Saleem team when Bobby and Tommy were on it. Again, we did really well. They drove with us too at Mid-Ohio. He forgets that, but
we finished second.
Yeah. So there's so many people. Charlie and I have been friends a long time, and Lance and I communicate once in a while over through Facebook. You guys have brought up so many names that I miss because it was like a traveling family. I mean, we're all trying to cut careers out of all of this, and it was just a great opportunity. And what the biggest advantage to me of the endurance races, despite the fact that it was hard work, was A, getting paid, and B, it hired so many drivers because you needed at least two, three, and sometimes in some of these cars, four drivers, and it put a lot of us to work. And, SCCA, what do you think? Asked me one time, what do you think if we shorten these races to like 2 hours? I said, you're going to unemploy a lot of good shoes, guys who really deserve a career in this industry. And so, but for me, it was an eye opener. I was blessed. The Saleem team at that time was a pretty damn good team, and the cars were very good. And we were blessed that we could get talent like the Archie brothers in. Lance and I never, the only time we got to drive together was with John Torek, and those very well prepared Hondas. It was just an amazing group of people and talent and drivers. And I miss some of these guys so much because it was so much fun to see them all the time.
You're speaking of Andy Pilgrim. He won the Porsche International GT race at Sebring last Sunday. Smoked everybody.
Yeah, he's good. That's a big talent.
Yeah, good guy, too.
Yeah, yep. From what I hear, I've never met him.
fast guy, a fast guy for sure. John Clark.
Since yes, sir.
Mentioned, tell us what you did out there in Escort Firehawk.
Well, you know, Randy Popes was talking about the first Sebring race, and that was my first race also. And I kind of ever, yeah, and I kind of circumvented the rules in that I hadn't even gone through any SCCA schools, but I'd been instructor, Porsche stuff, and then I had a chance to work with Bob Bondurant on the introduction of the AmeriCorps, and, you know, got to work with him for like 3 weeks. And I said, hey, Bob, I said, if you know, can you just send me a letter or do something, and I could, you know, give it to IMSA, and they could give me a provisional license and blah, blah, blah. And he said, sure. So anyway, I sent this BS letter to IMSA, and sure enough, I got a provisional license for the first Firehawk race. And, you know, they said, you know, you go out at practice and, you know, you let the pit steward know that, you know, you're on a provisional license and we watch you and, you know. So anyway, I got through the weekend, no incidents. And by the way, we came in third at that race. They didn't have us third at the finish of the race, but an hour after the race, they came up to us and actually handed us the plaque and said, no, you guys actually finished third. So it was pretty cool standing in pit lane. I was the second driver, and the announcer says the leader of the touring class has just entered the pit, and the only car in pit lane was my car. So, you know, getting into the lead car in the class in your first race was kind of interesting. But it went on from there. It was a fun ride for sure. I mean, the Escort Series, Playboy Series, I mean, I hear a lot of names, a lot of great drivers, and a lot of great drivers that started there and moved up through the ranks and did a lot of great things. I mean, you know, when you know, think about Tommy Kendall and you know, Dorsey and the rest of those guys. I mean, you know, Boris said, you know, you could go on and on and on about the drivers that came up through that class and the Volkswagen Cup and Renault Cup and went on to bigger and better things. But it was a fun time, a very good time in my life that I'll always treasure, and met a lot of long-lasting friends.
Yeah, I think everybody will say it was one of the best times in their lives. The best thing I found in endurance racing was the strategy that involved. I kind of stopped driving to manage a team because we usually had three cars out there. And the strategy was so important, and I miss that in one-hour races. You don't have any strategy to go fast. Speaking of strategy, there's a guy here who raced Peugeot. He's one of the rare outliers in the car.
Whoa.
Victor Van Tresch. Did you do some Escort stuff in the Peugeot?
No, actually. I mean, that was... we just did the SCCA Nationals. They were paying money, and I made $80,000 with the silly car. I still got it, and it runs fine. You know, it's hard to get rid of something that runs fine. So, but we had, I still have the car.
That's amazing.
I mean, it will not wear out. I swear to God, there's not a single Peugeot part that's worn out on the thing. Everything Bosch has gone south, but nothing Peugeot. So we made $80,000 with a car that we bought for like $8,000, and we drove it to every single race we ever ran, including, you know, Road Atlanta twice, but, I mean, Hallett, Oklahoma, Texas World Speedway, Pueblo, Colorado, Denver, Colorado, Seattle, Portland, so on and so forth. We'd drive it as far as we could get it and leave it at an airport and fly back. And then fly back again, get in the car, get to the track race, and get it to another airport and leave it there. that's the way we did it. It was great. But I did get a Playboy race at Riverside in Terry Rohr's Golf, and I got some rides in John Williamson's Rabbit. They were trying to fill the field at Riverside with in the Golf Cup, so they let some Bilstein cars run. So, oh, okay. And that was fun. Oiled down the track real well. Apparently, you can't put 5 quarts of oil in a rabbit. It spews all over the place. I don't know. Nobody told me any different. Okay. Got to run 4 quarts. Whatever. But we had a good time. The night race was kind of surprising because, you know, I was working in Marina Del Rey, and Terry Orr was out there at the track, and I got there about 8 o'clock at night. He says, well, you got to go out. And I go, nah, it's Riverside. It's golf. I'll do fine. And then he says, no, go out and, you know, to get some practice. So I went out there, and I made about 6 laps, and I come in, and he's sitting there looking at me, and he goes, you just went faster than we did all day. I said, well, it's Riverside. It's a golf. It doesn't change just because it got dark. But we had a good old time with that stuff, I'll tell you. And that was really the thing.
That Riverside race brought SPCA, or that was the first pro race Bill King had run the previous season as an amateur series, the U.S. Endurance Championship. So the Playboy race at Riverside really didn't have any results for about a week. The local scoring couldn't figure it out. And Sylvia Wilkinson and Judy Scopus sat in Sylvia's living room for a week and sorted out everybody's timesheet and came up with winners and losers. And the fact was, even today, nobody knows who the real winner was. That's just another SCCA thing.
Pretty glad it was pretty wild.
Score a thing, it was just a mess.
Judy Scopus,
no
kidding, he would.
Judy Scopus trained some of my timing people, and by the time we got to the next 24-hour race, I think in Ohio in 85, we had really good scoring going on, and our results matched the official results, and everybody was fine. But, blame it on SCC.
Dave, this is Mitch Wright talking about Puggios. I had the opportunity to do a handful of races and one back in the early days. I don't remember what year it was, but it was in 85.
Did Riverside?
On the West Coast. I think we did Riverside, Phoenix, and one other race. And I'll tell you what.
I got pictures of your car spinning out in turn 4.
That wasn't me.
I'll tell you what. That was the most comfortable race
yes.
car I ever drove. That
Velour
thing seat,
power steering, air conditioning. I mean, who could ask for more, right?
No rolls.
And you know, it was bloody fast.
No, it really was. I've still got the stupid thing. I'm going to vintage race it someday.
Well, Victor, you still have an Alliance Cup car.
Well, I did. I sold it not too long ago. I'm really sad about that. Got $3,000 for it, and it went off to Riverside. Some guy, I don't know if he's going to do lemons with it or whatever. And as a Levin's car, if you can keep anybody from hitting it, you know, that 12-gallon tank, you can go like 400 miles in the silly thing because it gets, I think we got 29 miles of the gallon at Riverside, floored. That's as low as you could get it. We put racing gas in it, and it slowed it down about a second a lap, and so we were all trying to get the racing gas out of the car and put the regular unleaded back in it. And, man, it took a long time to get the gas out of that thing.
Do you still have the guy's name that bought the car?
Probably not impossible to find. But, I mean, that was Tom Cleese's car, and that was, you know, that car had 35,000 race miles on it. It had never been registered for the street, never driven on the street. It had 35,000 miles on it.
I just ended up with a whole bunch of Alliance parts I need to sell.
Oh, well, the guys in Riverside, I can probably dig up some for
you. I'd appreciate that.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I went to buy a pair of fenders for my R5 race car and bought 11 cars and a truckload of parts.
It kind of happens that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All you needed was a door handle. You wound up with a whole car. Okay. But Cleve's car was, I mean, it was special.
What's that?
What?
Trish, why don't you take over the questioning here? I know you got some questions for these guys.
Oh, I don't know. y'all doing really well by yourselves. I don't want to come up with something.
Put a bunch of racers in a room to talk about racing. Okay.
Well, that's what we do. And usually it's so lively, I can't get a word in edgewise anyway, which is just as well.
How are we doing so far?
Oh, you're doing wonderful. Do you want me to do a station identification, Dave?
Yeah, sure. I'm losing my voice.
Okay. Oh, you're losing your voice?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Okay, station identification. This is Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever and ever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's go around in order and ask everybody what their best race or favorite race or worst race was, something like that.
Well, the most memorable, crazy. Yeah, we need to hear some crazy stories.
Start off with who's next.
I got a lot of them, but I mean, it was pretty funny. You know, there's a few guys here in this audience that are from Mulholland Drive, okay? And we raced with the lights off all the time because why did you need a whole bunch of bright lights in front of you when you were turning right? Okay, so we just turned the lights off. Well, when I went to Riverside and I practiced I raced in the dark, I came up behind a guy and I turned off the lights. You know, I mean, I don't need him. I don't need to light up the back end of his car. Boy, did that freak him out.
I'll bet it did.
Hold on. Yeah, and, because I had been a corner worker, I figured that's why I didn't get called in. They went, oh, that's just victory. We'll ignore that.
We'll blame this on Randy, particularly at Nelson Ledger's. On at least a couple of occasions, Randy got in the car at 2 a.m. and set the new lap record, broke the lap record, went faster and faster, stayed in for two or three stints. And people come up to me and say, gee, how much slower do you guys go in the dark? And I look at my chart and say, well, so Randy just knocked another 2 seconds off the lap record in the dark. So blame him.
Thank you, Dave. Well, you know, it's cooler, and the engines make more power when there's less heat, when that cold, dense air. And as we know, those showroom stock tires get so hot, like Bobby said, that at night they don't generate as much heat. The track is cooler, which is actually an advantage for a street tire.
Yeah, turn on the heater.
Turn the boost up, and the fact that for almost everybody here was racing on tires that you couldn't buy, we had three or four new types of tires every weekend, did a lot of tire testing, and sometimes tires would only go three laps. It was not much showroom stock, as Rick said, about any of this stuff.
Yeah, but the brakes were always terrible. That's what I remember.
Brakes were always terrible is right.
They were always terrible, and if you were good at saving brakes, that was a key talent.
It was.
He went out for his stint to drive and said, boy, the car's got no power, and they told him to turn on the radio, and that cranked the boost up by 10 PSI.
I know that story. No, that's a Volvo wagon at Atlanta, and Ron Cortez was driving it.
Yeah. And actually,
turn the radio up.
Any of us who had turbo cars had various interesting things to raise the boost and turn it back down.
Yeah, I had one guy with an electronic wastegate, and he had it hooked up to the radio, so he turned the volume down, the car would slow down, and he got busted. He got busted because he had the track worker in the car at the time, and he turned it down, the car slowed down. The guy went, wait a minute, we got to look into that.
John Norris, later on, actually, when we raced an international sedan, and actually required a boost gauge to be hooked up with a kind of flexible hose to the gauge. And we found that after you set the boost where you wanted on the pit lane, you just crimped it off with a vice grip. Took the vice grip off and the bridge. And by the second or third race, we found this hose was all damaged everywhere because everybody was crimping it down, so they could set the boost on the gauge for instance and then go race for whatever boost they wanted. Guess it's okay to talk about that now because that's 30 years ago.
Yes, statute of limitations.
Statute of limitations. You cheaters.
Oh, yeah. You guys with healing. No, you know, I heard that the Corvettes, some of the Corvettes had, they'd come in on the last lap, and they'd put on a different set of wheels and tires, And what I heard was those wheels and tires weighed 100 pounds each more than the wheels that they took off. That's a good idea. So the car wouldn't be underweight.
I got to tell this story, you guys. In the early days, they didn't check boost at all. This is Randy Popes, by the way. And
by the way.
But then they got a little bit better at it, and they would measure the boost off the intake manifold. And I swear I never did this kind of stuff, but in my brain, I thought about how you could put a line on that boost line that had a little spring and ball in it. Like, this is all in my head. And it would bleed off the boost pressure just to the gauge that the officials were using, right? I swear to you, this is only in my head. Well, my wife, Linda Popst, got a deal with a team that had a couple of Eagle Talons from a Paul Rossi team. How about that for a name, everybody? Paul Rossi.
Yeah, Paul Rossi. Yeah.
Yes, I helped work on the cars for this little team that Linda was driving for, and I'm looking at this Eagle Talon, and I found the exact device that I had invented in my brain. It was on Paul Rossi's car. There was a bleed off the line that they measured the boost with for the officials, right? That would bleed off pressure only in that line with a little ball and a spring so you could calibrate it.
Yeah, not surprised. Paul Rossi protested me quite a few times and always lost the protest. John actually made $1,000. John Morris made $1,000 if I speak. After Paul insisted we were cheating, we had to take the car apart, and of course it was okay. That's why Paul Rossi's probably not here tonight. But anyway. So Charlie Downs, what was your most memorable race?
Oh, I had lots of them.
I can take that corner flat out.
What was that?
I can take that corner flat out. There was a famous saying from Charlie Downs. It says, I can take that corner flat out. And, of course, he was on his roof. He rolled it in that corner.
You're telling a story I don't know about.
Oh, darn. Yeah, I know. It probably knocked you silly when you went upside down. No, and that was in one of Boland's cars, too, as I recall.
What
I don't know.
The hell are you talking about?
I don't know, man. I am. You know me. I've been in the hospital a lot. So
yeah, somebody banged your head someplace. You're talking about somebody. Anyway, my memorable races, Mitsubishi, unlike Rick, I loved the 24-hour races. And Mid-Ohio, myself and Scott Gaillard, who is the one who got me in at Honda, we couldn't get away from each other for about three. We were in together for about three stints. And he came over to the pits after to find out who it was, and that's how come I ended up on the gong show at Honda. Honda was another experience. One of the ones that I'll never forget is at Watkins Glen at night, and you just get into rhythm, and it seemed like I was going too fast with Charlie Kernut, and he kept telling me to slow down, and all of a sudden I'm going, he slowed me down so much, I'm about 5 seconds elapsed slower than I was going before. And people that had been passing way through the night all of a sudden are catching up with me. And one guy ran me off at the downhill after the sweeper off the back straight. And if you want to talk about being on the lid, UVT, it was, I ended up on the lid there because the guy stuffed me into the fence. But
yeah,
I was really worried about that. It wasn't necessary for Charlie to slow me down that much. I don't know. But when you break a rhythm at night, you always end up in a bad situation. And that one I can't forget. And the only other time I've been on my lid is in the Mitsubishi at Mosport when the dip seized up going into the downhill at turn two. I had
I only heard the other end of that part. I can take that turn flat out. Okay, now the differential breaks. Okay, that's fine. That makes more sense. But I only heard the other half of that, which wasn't from you, by the way. It was probably Lance or Norris or somebody.
It couldn't have been because they weren't on the Mitsubishi team. But the problem was that we changed the diff. The new diff burnt up, and they put the old diff back in and seized up. Simple as that. The only time I've had an injury, broke a rib.
Wow.
That was funny because the car hit the wall sideways and apparently had been up in the air quite high, came back down on the side. And at that time, we were running the stock leather seats, and the belt didn't hold, so my nose is over on the glove compartment on the right side, and the gear shift stuck me in the rib and broke it. So those are memories, but there are lots of other good ones, too.
Lots of them, yeah.
Racing the 24-hour would be one of my favorites. I miss those, the long-distance races. How many 20 we had? Was it 5 24 hours in one year?
Yes. That's correct.
But they were good. I also ran at most sports one time with the Archers when they were running the No Fear guys. They actually put me in there and had a lot of fun in that team.
That was a wild race.
It was.
Mitch was the designated winner for the Archer team that year. And I remember we built the car just to be a rabbit. And the idea was for me to go out as fast as I could and try to get the Hondas to catch us. And then, you know, the No Fear guys were just kind of messing things up. And it rained out for like 4 hours at the start.
Right.
So we took off and I basically tried to burn the car down. Incredibly, the No Fear guys had to park the car because they were on, I think, Toyo tires. And the other guys, we had Mitch just watch the pits, and our other two cars broke. So after almost 4 hours, I'm driving this car, and second gear went out. And we're still in the lead. And that was the car that ended up winning the race with no second gear. But I beat the living daylights out of it for 4 hours. Remember that, Mitch?
It was like in the Renault Cup. Everybody would take the stickers off the car and then take it down to a dealership and trade it in.
If you guys have been racing 24-hour race in St. Louis, the 24-hour Firehawk race, I think it was 85.
Too many people.
And some of you were there. We ran a couple of Starions. For whatever reason, broke the gearbox, could only run 40 gears in one car, and managed to hold on for a win because it was from practice. We were only going maybe a second or two slower. It was only fourth gear. Got better gas mileage. But it took a Spanish thing.
Lots of good times.
Yeah.
Minimize your shifting. Yeah. Always good advice in an endurance race, even if it's forced.
Okay. How about your most memorable race?
Who was that, Dave?
Yeah, Mark Mitchell.
Oh wow! You got to. I can remember vividly one year we were. This was probably 96, 97 at Road Atlanta. It was a Firehawk series, and we were running the house Nissans, and they were touring, I believe, that year. And yeah, we're running the race and go down into turn one, and S's dry as a bone. We came out the backside. This is one that didn't have that little wiggle in the end. It was a pretty, you know, rewarding bravery kind of corner. You went into the dip and up the hill and over the brow there. But I forget who was leading, but basically there was a cloud burst. It was like someone took a zipper on a water balloon, and half the field went off into the dip. I mean, literally, there were probably 30 or 40 cars that never made it around that lap. And I can vividly remember an M3 upside down in the trees, driver's right going into the dip. And it was probably 25, 30 feet in the air because the trees were quite tall there. But it was that was spectacular. But going back to, Rick had mentioned something, I'm sure, a lot of people can relate. A bunch of people on this call started it, well, did Renault Cup, the Alliance Cup on the West Coast. I know Charlie was an East Coast guy, but, when that series ended, it was like magically this endurance thing kind of opened up, and so many people, because there were long races back then, that has not been since then, that they had two series where you had a pretty large amount of 12 hours, 24 hours. So many people were kind of, in a bit of a limbo between, Alliance Cup, and then this thing happened. So many people were fortunate and got the opportunity to kind of migrate to those blossoming series. And there really hasn't been anything since those days where you had, a lot of opportunity open up. There's a series right now a lot of people don't know about. It's kind of sneaking up, and I think it's going to mimic those two series very quickly here. It's called World Racing League, and they run a lot of the 6-hour, 28 hours. I've been doing a couple of those, and it is, like some of the popular races like Dakota sells out 100 cars in 20 minutes of registration opening up. There's a huge amount of people running that, and it's fantastic racing. And it reminds me of that period. There hasn't been anything since then till now except for this World Racing League. So really cool stuff if you happen to check it out.
Mitch, do you remember our adventures in Europe?
Yeah.
How can I forget?
with the American flag on the door, which I heard was like a target.
That was a target, yeah. It was.
It was a target, yeah.
We went over there, and all of a sudden we realized that most of the Italians and the French cars were narrower than the cars that we ran. I think they gave us some brand-new cars that weren't up to what the others were running, but I'd never realized why they were slimmer until we got into the race and got taken out. They don't hit you in the back. They hit you on the side. So in France, at Paul Ricard, coming down the back straight into Seine, which is the fast right-hander, and they draft up alongside me and slam me, and I'm headed for this gray thing that looked like a concrete block that they had for markers. And hit it, and the thing just exploded. It looked like concrete, but it happened to be some kind of styrofoam. But
boom!
There were a couple of guys there, American guys, who were doing the Elf School, that happened to be at that corner. One was Carl Cormier, and the other one was
Leighton Reese.
Right, Leighton.
Leighton Reese was there.
Right. Yeah. Said, boy, that thing went off like a bomb. We thought you were going to hit concrete, too. And the old catch fences in France, they had the wire. Mitch, did you get caught up in the catch fence?
No, I didn't. Actually, on the first lap, I ended up getting shoved off the track in the first corner and ended up on the back side of the catch fence and the back side of the trees going down that short chute. I don't remember what it was, but I ended up pulling back between the trees and getting back on the racetrack.
Alan Polk got pushed off into that.
I got hooked up with an Italian racer that we had a lot of fun with.
Well, it's the first time I've seen team tactics. That was the first time I'd ever seen that between the French and the Italians running if they're doing Tour de France.
I kind of opened this up to the audience. Any questions from anybody in the audience?
Questions? Well,
yes, now. Okay.
Well,
continue where we were there. Rick Titus, tell us about a memorable moment.
Well, obviously, sewing up the championship in 87 at Sebring, a town my father grew up in, was very important to me. But it's going to surprise him a little bit, but Lance Stewart and I, driving for John, also at Sebring in a very important race. The Hondas, there were a lot of fast ones, and Lance had a lot more experience. This is my first race in a Honda, and I was blown away at how good they were. But Lance said, look, those guys are going to go through brake pads, so stick with me. You and I will fall back because they're going to take off, but this is going to work because in the end, we won't be in changing pads. And I don't remember if you remember the call we got from John, Lance, but you and I were like 10th and 11th, and a nervous John Dork says, hey, guys, you're like 10th and 11th. Are you sure this is going to work? And Lance just said, yeah, hang in. Yeah, sure and shit. And I just had so much fun working with Lance. And the year before, when Lance was in those cars, the Pate brothers were not I didn't really enjoy those guys. You guys might as well love them. I don't know. But they were not good about moving over for faster cars. And we were at Sebring. I knew it counted for Honda. And I knew Lance was in. It was right near the end of the race. And so when I got to a situation where I could catch both of them, I might have made it inconvenient for one of them to turn left, and I might have made it even more inconvenient for the other one to turn right. And so Lance saw these headlights coming, and he said, man, Rick, when you pulled up next to me, I was so relieved because whoever it was pissed. You remember that, Lance?
Those were some good times.
It was awesome. I was so proud to be able to pull up next to you and go, hey, don't worry about those boys anymore. They're not on your back anymore. That got handled. So those are the moments that are so special. Having the Archers drive with us, it would have been wonderful. But Celine wasn't a team where everyone worked together. It was really a business, and you got plugged in. You did your job, and, you know, the motorhome was interesting sometimes. And, you know, like Celine said, when Parnelli and Fulmer joined us, he said, look, these are showroom stock Mustangs, and it cost me $65,000 each to make them that way. And back then, that was a lot of money to spend on a stock Mustang. just how it was. But that's what made it so bitchin'. We were all driving cars way quicker than people thought. And I don't hate 24-hour races, but as a teenager that finally got to do it, I was just shocked how hard of work they are, because mentally, you really got to manage this equipment. And like's been brought up several times, the tires were not forever. Those general tires had the reason we didn't warm them up on the pace laps because we knew we had two good laps. So I didn't want any extra heat in the damn things. And you really had to manage the car, try to get the best gas mileage. And has also been brought up is that we did go quicker at night. I'm not saying that was the most fun, but as Randy pointed out, the cars were faster at night. And we often went quicker than we did in qualifying at nighttime. But one last story before I get away. Pete Halsner was on the team, and we were at Sebring, and some novel journalist, we were in a little press thing, and this chick says, well, why do you guys need all those headlights? It's, you know, you must know the track like the back of your hand. And Halsner, and all of us know Pete, who's a pretty quiet, reserved guy generally, said, really, you know your living room pretty good, don't you? And she said, well, of course. And he goes, good. Tonight, with all the lights off, would you run across it for me? I'd like to see your shins tomorrow. You know, Mitch could have done that. We'd all laugh because Mitch could do that. But and Lance could easily have done it. But coming from Halsner just made it that much funnier because he's not a guy that generally stirred the pot that hard. But those are the memories, Dave. You know, those are the I miss seeing Lance and Mitch and the Archer brothers and Torek and of course, you know, I just been friends with so many of these people so long, and then all of a sudden it just gets kind of cut off at the knees, and it's kind of sad. But yeah, it was a great time in our lives.
Have a general.
Hey, I got a great story, Dave. Dave, can I tell my story again? Another one?
Sure.
This is Randy Pope's. And it was early, like 1987. Yeah, 1987 Firehawk race, 24 hours at Watkins Glen. I'm running my own Toyota FX16 in touring cars. And in the middle of the night, I'm running, and I'm running with a Camaro. And I realized I can just catch this Camaro in the brake zone for turn one at Watkins Glen, because the brakes were so terrible, especially on the bigger cars that were a little faster. The Camaro guy had to let off real early, but I realized, why pass this guy in turn one at Watkins Glen before going all the way down that straightaway? He's just going to blow back by me. And then a little bit later, the same guy, we're turning the same lap times, but in very, very different ways because he's got twice the horsepower, literally, probably more. Well, this guy started letting me go by him at the other end of the straightaway at turn five. And so we ended up in the middle of a race, in the middle of the night. We made a deal without having to speak to each other, where going into turn one, I would never try to dive bomb him, even though I could. And going into turn five, he would stay wide and let me go under him, because that led to the toe of the boot, which was all a bunch of corners. And with the Toyota FX16, it had better brakes for the weight. I could stay ahead of him. And I remember at the end of the stint, I think we did that twice. I'm like, who is in that number, whatever it was, Camaro? I got to meet that guy. Well, you'll remember this name, Brad Hoyt. What a crazy, wild personality. Right? It was Brad Hoyt. He was a very outgoing, nutty party guy. He ran with Leighton Reese, who was another wonderful guy. And Brad and I were like brothers from that moment on the rest of our lives. That's why Charlie Downs talked about how you get a rhythm. We got a rhythm, and he worked with me, and it worked, and we were just brothers from then on.
Yep.
Rick,
I got one at Riverside.
That General Tire story that I had, the first time General Tire turned up, it was at Brainerd, and I kept going in behind this car, and I can't remember what car it was. But it seemed like every time he went into turn one, the big high-speed sweeper, I'd see this black string keep coming off the tires, and it would end up on the windshield. And finally, it dawned on me after the second time, those tires, it was actually the tire coming off the edge, and it would have this string that extended from the back of his car all the way to the Mitsubishi. And that was the first time we realized they were running a compound that was totally different to everybody else's.
Oh, yeah. They got to be pretty good.
Yeah. Dave, this is Torak. I've got a story. So, you know, all you guys, you're hero race car drivers. And, you know, I went from a race car driver to an owner to chassis guy. But, you know, the one thing, and Bobby Archer and all the guys that worked on their own cars could testify to this. None of those cars were made to race, and any of the suspension adjustments were a chore. Mm-hmm. So it's just like the Hondas. They had that cast iron upright. And, Mark, you were... God bless you. That one broke on you at Mosport in the 24 hour. But we used to have to heat those and bend them. So you had a set of uprights for, you know, 1 degree, 2 degrees, 3 degrees, because you were allowed up to 3 degrees in SCCA. So, you know, you had to go through. And so changing camber was not an easy deal because you had to change the whole front knuckle out. Well, you know, we had a lot of success in tuning the cars and, you know, getting everything right and scaling them and stuff like that. But the race I remember, and it's from being a tuner, and it was a Firehawk race at Road America. And Lance was driving with Mitch Payton, and it was in a Prelude. Do you remember this, Lance?
Well, I don't know. Tell the story.
Okay. Yeah. So,
that's right. So you're anyway, not guilty till proven so, Lance. Be careful.
Right. But Charlie and all
leading
ignorant. People,
ignorance.
Yeah. You know, they're coming down and they're telling everybody more camber, more camber. You need more camber, more camber. And so at night after the last practice session, you know, we didn't have computers to tune cars, and we didn't have G meters to you know, see how fast you were going in the corners and this and that. So the poor chassis guy or crew chief or whatever had to depend on, you know, this so-called driver that was sitting in the seat to give you the feedback. And sometimes you got feedback by accident. And Lance was talking about Road America, and then all of a sudden he said something that, you know, turn 1-2 going and then going back down, he said, is just like driving in the rain. He says it's like being on a wet racetrack. So in the morning before that race, there was a 15-minute or a half-hour warm-up. So I told the guys, I said, I'm going to make this change. And I said, but I want to let you know that we aren't going to have time to change it back if it doesn't work. You know, you're stuck with whatever you're going to drive with this. So I took the camber out of the car, and the car ended up going like a second or a little over a second a lap faster. And pretty soon, Kernut and Dix and all of them are down at our pit. And they're going, what did you do? What did you do? What did you do? And I said, I listened to my driver, my data acquisition system there, who said it's like driving in the rain. So what do you do in the rain? You stand them up and you soften the suspension. And you know, we picked up, the car was extremely fast, but it had a scored cylinder and it blew the engine up. But we were leading quite nicely for a while. But that goes back. I mean, I think some of the better tuners, I mean, nowadays you have the computers and the engineers and they look at all this stuff and you kind of lose track of the basics, which is you got four little circles that are holding you on the ground that are maybe 3 inches to 4 inches in diameter. And how are you going to maximize that all the time? And, you know, there's no substitute for a good driver that gives good input.
Mm-hmm. I think Oscar Jackson turned it.
We never took a torch to the spindle. That sounded like a scary thing to do. But we had relocated suspension pickup points in a bunch of different areas and then had all kinds of offset bushings. And sometimes had 2 degrees camber on one side and 3 degrees on the other and back and forth and so on. And again,
yeah,
like,
we did that.
Yeah, like everybody,
we did that through Castor.
Poor guys who went and bought a new Mitsubishi Staria and wondered why they were 5 seconds a lap slower because Staria cost $50,000 a piece to build. End of story.
Oh yeah.
What kind of teams did you have? I'm going to ask you a question. The number of team members on your team, wrenches and all that.
Well, we usually ran three cars with a dozen people, a couple volunteers, and the rest were full-time employees. Mitsubishi spent a lot of money. I'm still living off it, actually, so it went well. And all the other guys who had factory programs had equal amounts of money or property. It was a big deal.
Well, we didn't, buddy. At DC Klein Racing, we had one toolbox for three or four cars. I remember this so clearly. And a guy would be like, I need the 12-millimeter wrench. And the guy two cars over is like, okay, I'll be done in about 10 minutes. One 12-millimeter wrench, three or four Hondas. We didn't have that budget.
Well, you just have the right sponsor.
That's right.
Hey, buddy, I was so glad for what I had. Still am.
At Willow Springs, there was a 12-hour race, and it was firehawking, so you had the Camaros and Firebirds out there. Well, as I understand it, you know, they had roller-bearing hubs, and they didn't last real long. And so everybody who had a Camaro or Firebird went out and rented a Camaro or Firebird and just parked it in the parking lot. So at the end of the day, assuming that they didn't have any failures, they swapped parts between the rental cars and the race cars so that the race cars were in better shape. So the next year, You could not rent a Camaro or a Firebird anywhere anywhere in that area. You could not. They learned their lesson. They said, what do you mean you got your car back? And it was all wore out, too. Okay, I get it. That was fun stuff.
That was a common happening at all the 24-hour races, actually. But the guys that had real, genuine factory programs that I had with Mitsubishi, Nissan was out there with Pepe Pombo and my other people. Suddenly, Celine's operation and the factory Hondas had pretty much unlimited budget as long as you were winning and producing the advertising. That was just called marketing flowing. And we did, and yeah, I'm proud to say that we certainly put Mitsubishi on the map. That didn't do much for them today. They're in the toilet again. But the guys with factory programs had a lot of money to spend and a lot of inside information that the rest of the people couldn't have. Back before there was all this electronics, we had a computer guy in Orange County who came out testing at Willow with three or four different computers. He tried this, he tried that, and look at whatever data acquisition we had at the time. I had a Mitsubishi 286 computer that was built like a suitcase, and that was it back in the day.
Hey, Dave, I've got to jump in. Randy Pope's here. I got a story about you, Dave Wallen. When I first started driving for you.
When you were sleeping on the floor in my house in Palos Verdes. So go on from there, yeah.
Exactly. When I was in your house in Palos Verdes, I got up and went to the bathroom. I lift the toilet seat, and there's a picture of a driver you were mad at. You glued his face to the inside of the toilet seat for target practice.
Yeah, I don't remember who that was, do you?
Oh, gosh. Mike Rutherford? Is that a name?
No, it wouldn't have been Mike.
No, I've never. Yeah.
No, he's a nice guy. I can't remember.
Yeah.
It was one of your guys, and you were mad at him.
Oh. Holy
shit.
No, I must have fired him. I don't
remember who it was. Sounds like a deal.
Yeah. That was 85 or 86.
And I don't think I think it was later than that. When we were doing the Nelson Ledges 24-hour, I got to do that with you a couple of times. I wrecked your car once, but they fixed it, thank God. I appreciate that, Dave. Thank you. It was fun in those eclipses.
Yeah, we kind of traded off with archers, but Bobby and Tommy won at Nelson 2 years that I didn't go, I think, 88, 89 maybe. And then we were there with you and Tisha Klein and that bunch in 90 and 91, I guess.
And Peter Schwartzot.
And Peter, yeah.
Well, it wasn't me because I was long gone, but I never thanked Dave for allowing me to do the development on the race trucks. And one of the questions that I never got answered, Dave, was, why did we get disqualified at that first race at Sears?
Oh, that was all politics. SCCA had wanted Mitsubishi to contribute $50,000 to some points fund, and I had no control over that stuff, and I brought it to Mitsubishi. They had laughed at me. We were already spending $20,000. And as a result, they found a couple of those minor discrepancies, actually, in the belt timing. So all three of them, my first, second, and fifth, we were all three got disqualified. We protested the disqualification, and a couple of guys from Mitsubishi went back to a hearing in Denver, and they just didn't want to hear about it. We were kind of on the outside. And again, it's SCCA, what do you want?
Yep.
It's funny.
The trucks are fun to drive, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, not a topic for tonight, but the truck series. I'll kind of take credit for inventing it. The first time we tested trucks, I think you were there, Charlie, and Willis Springs, Jay Leno was there, and Scott was there. And so,
somebody's got way too much noise going on back there.
I don't know who that is, not here. Everybody's not talking, should be muted. So anyway, here we were at Willow, and Walker Evans and Ron Hornaday, and Jim Smith, the NASCAR stock car guys, were watching. They went home to Bakersfield, where Ron Hornaday owned a company called 15 Circle, and they built what became NASCAR trucks. They ran them in Michigan before they became a national program. And laughed at the fact that we were running little four bangers. I remember Walker saying, I have sold them our motors out of our off-road racing program, our stadium racing program. And Walker just laughed. I was doing that with a four banger, which put V8s in it. Anyway, so much for trucks.
Yep.
Go on, Trish. We're putting this up here pretty soon.
One more thing about trucks.
Just let me know.
Go ahead.
I'll never forget the first time I went into turn six at Riverside in the truck, and it was like, whoa, this thing is like four turns lock to lock. You really had to turn the steering wheel a lot to get around any turn. And I, you know, that was my first lap in the thing. It was like, wow, that's slow.
I think actually most of you guys on here tonight also raced trucks. I know Bobby did. And Rick Titus, you didn't get to drive a truck. Torak, you ran a truck.
Yeah, a couple of races with Celine. Mm-hmm. It was good. You know, I just want to say it's been an honor to have had memories with you guys, you know, Lance and Charlie, and obviously Bobby, we don't talk too much more. Mitch and I communicate once in a while on Facebook, but, you know, John Torek, who I get to see at SEMA mostly, just great, great people. Thank you so much for that valuable time in my life. I'll never forget you guys.
I think Mitch Wright ought to invite us all down to his track and give us Corvettes and let us just have a reunion day with his cars. How about that, Mitch?
I would be more than happy to do that, except for one minor detail, which is I'm retired.
What? That's not an excuse.
It happens to the best of us.
Yeah, well, I'm still doing some racing, but I'm no longer working a full-time job by any means.
Oh, no, you still don't play. Goodness gracious.
I'm only doing fun stuff now.
Mitch, whatever happened to your old boss that designed the tracks?
Alan Wilson?
Yeah.
I think he's pretty much retired. He was doing some stuff in China. He's still out living in Utah. He didn't design the track here in Kentucky, but he did a couple other tracks. He did Miller and NOLA and some of those. But he's still kicking around. I talk to him every 4 or 5 months, I guess. He's doing well.
I'll say hello.
Did he design that hole? Did he design that hole that all the Corvettes fell into? Was that his deal? I thought that was pretty interesting.
He didn't design the track. I happened to be here when that happened, and that was the most bizarre thing I'd ever.
That was bizarre. You're sitting there looking at this thing, and there's the cars, and they're just tilting up and up and up, and then they're gone. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
That's bad.
Yeah. Well, this whole area here is full of, it's a limestone, and so it's not an uncommon occurrence. It's kind of uncommon to happen in the middle of a building, but it's not an uncommon occurrence.
Okay, Trish, let's wind this up. You guys, it's been a great show, and the recording will be up tomorrow, and I'll tell you how big the audience is and let you hear the recording.
Thanks everybody.
Go ahead.
Trish, you there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, if anybody's got anything they want to say before the end, if they've been sitting on something, go ahead and tell us, you know.
Well, I just want to, this is Mitch Wright, I just want to mimic what Rick has said, that, you know, we race with a lot of these guys, and we're teammates with some of them, and every one of them had made me better, and I enjoyed every minute of it.
I'll second that.
I'm so glad you could join us.
Well, he's got nothing.
You know, we've all been pretty tough competitors, but it's amazing how we're all friends at the end of the day.
Yep.
That's right. That's
Kevin
right.
On this phone. A lot of talent.
Yeah, Bobby, great respect for you and Tommy, the Archer brothers, man. You guys were good. You were tough.
Oh,
and
man.
Well, I enjoyed watching y'all race a lot.
Yep. I appreciate that.
I got slammed in the hairpin at Sebring, and I was so mad. I was going to kill that guy in that Firebird, I think. And I found out it was Mark Mitchell, and I went, Mark Mitchell? He's a great guy. He's a really good driver. And I talked to him. He goes, yeah, I know. I lost my brakes. I hit you in the door so I wouldn't hurt your suspension so you could keep going. And it was true.
Well, that's
thanks,
nice.
Mark.
You'll never hear that anywhere else. Oh, that's
no.
funny. I love it.
By the way, before we go, I just happened to bump into somebody that had one of the old Kelsey Hayes wheels that they put on the Firebirds and the Camaros to solve their brake problem. And the guy didn't know where he got them from. He only had two. I don't know if you remember the Aero wheels that they originally made at Kelsey Hayes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They're all twisted to pull the air out.
Yep.
Honda had some wheels like that.
Yeah, we had set the guy that restored the 42 car. He was lucky. I think they had eight or nine of them that came with the car.
Wow.
Operating loss.
Should get P.D. Cunningham on this, right? I mean, he's got a museum.
Cunningham would be hilarious.
Yeah, Petey's got the 89 Honda that I had up there at his place.
Yep, sure does. I thought it was pretty funny. You'd turn the Yokohama 008s inside out on the back, and then on the front you'd loosen the front sway bar. That was a hairy ride, but it would corner. Remember that? That was a Willow. Yeah, it worked, but it was hairy, man. I mean, because you turn in and the front end plow and the back end was flying around. Whoa. Okay. Guess it's supposed to do this.
Well, we did a lot of things to make those things go around corners you weren't supposed to do.
Yeah, they weren't. They actually didn't want to go around a corner, but you could fool it quite a bit and get it to go around the corner.
Okay, Trish, wind it up here.
Okay, we're running out of gas. I thank you all for great stories and for joining us. This was a series that I watched a good bit back in the 80s. I never got to meet many of you, but I was there a good bit of the time and just hanging out, enjoying seeing all kinds of different cars. So thanks for joining us and telling us all this. And thank you to our audience out there in telephone land or whatever we're doing. And thanks for listening. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and new also on the Internet Archive, archive.org. Our next show, a month away, Wednesday, and I think it's the 13th. We're still playing with the date. 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. We'll cover in-depth racing riders. Hear how Sean Cridlin, Bert Levy, Jonathan Ingram, and possibly George Levy, and maybe another one or two, climbed the mountains of racing lore from interviews, photos, personal experience to create the definitive books that we have on our shelves today. So don't miss that. Until then, good night, goodbye from Trish at Race Talk with Trish. Thank you.